Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Happy Friday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix with Lauren Gilger. I'm Steve Goldstein. This summer, we're changing things up a bit on the show with a focus on local and regional coverage with a one-hour program every weekday morning at 9. And that means it is already time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This is not a salary increase. It's just a little extra money to cover our expenses. And I defy anybody that thinks they can come down to Phoenix and live on $60 a day. It's not possible. To deny us enough money to have just a standard living while we're in session, it's not right.
As we've seen from this White House, they'll do something that seems very blustery, but it actually moves international policy. Taxing ourselves in this fashion, I'm having trouble sort of seeing how that moves Mexican policy.
And I spoke with the president of Mexico. I get along with him very well, and we made this deal. But this is something the U.S. has been trying to get for over 20 years with Mexico. They've never been able to do it. As soon as I put tariffs on the table, it was done. It took 2 days.
Basically, you have to think of members of Congress as kind of independent contractors. And in this case, one of the allegations is this former chief of staff was spending money from the congressional account, the official federal taxpayer dollars, to benefit Schweikert's campaign, which is not allowed. That would be a violation of federal law.
And with us to talk about the ongoing ethics investigation involving Congressman David Schweikert, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego's first State of the City address, and more, are Paul Bentz of High Ground and Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak. Guys, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Chip, let's start off with David Schweikert at this point. 424-page report, Office of Congressional Ethics released this. How bad does this potentially look for Schweikert, even as far as public perception goes?
You know, it's never a good sign going into an election year when you're under a, quote, I'm doing air quotes now, ethics investigation. We don't know how serious the charges are, how they will be played out in the public sphere. But, you know, 424-page report is nothing to sneeze at or laugh off. The one thing that's curious is we've seen this in the history of politics where said politician throws his chief of staff under the bus, which has been a tactic that has not worked well in the past, especially if that chief of staff doesn't want to be loyal anymore and turns on their former boss. So I think it's a big deal. You know, we say money follows momentum in politics. Money also runs away from controversy. So if you look at Congressman Schweikert's bank account, it's not that thick. I actually looked yesterday. Former Congressman Matt Salmon, who's been working for ASU for quite some time, I think has a bigger campaign account still than David Schweikert right now.
Wow.
So this is good news for the Democratic challenger like Harold Tempranini, who can raise significant funds. It is a +10 Republican district. Full disclosure, I am a constituent, not involved in the campaign. But this will be a tough challenge for Schweikert.
And Paul, what surprised me is before we turned the mics on, you said you haven't had time to read the entire report. what do you make of where Schweikert's at right now?
400 pages is light reading, unfortunately. I'll try to get to it this weekend. At the end of the day, I know Chip just mentioned it's a +10 district. It's actually a +19 Republican participation district. It's a heavily Republican district. He is not vulnerable to a Democrat challenger unless this thing continues to unravel. At this point, he would be more vulnerable to, say, a Republican challenger, which nobody's come out of the woodwork to do that quite yet. But really, this is about his chief of staff, not about the congressman. And so if more information comes out, something comes to light, maybe that'll change. But for now, despite the light bank account, he's in a good spot unless a Republican decides to challenge him.
So there's no Democrat in your mind that could make this challenge worthwhile. I mean, Tipperneni did pretty well in a pretty heavily Republican, better than others thought she might, in a pretty heavily Republican district last time around.
Right, but not this district. She was in the West Valley. No, so she's lost two times now. Carpetbagging to another district. Even in the blue wave in 2018, it was a +17 Republican participation. She would basically need to win every Democrat and every independent and get some Republicans to turn her way to win this thing. It's a really steep hill. The way our districts are set up, CD6 is not a competitive district.
Are we being unfair?
It's possible,
yeah. but are we being unfair to Anita Malik then? Because Anita Malik actually does live in that district. Is not a carpetbagger, Paul, as you labeled Tipper Nanny. So
yeah, I think we have a long way to go before August or November of 2020. I think a lot of this will be driven by who is a Democratic presidential candidate. I think if it's I don't know what labels we use now, but a moderate centrist Joe Biden versus Donald Trump in Arizona with Mark Kelly on the ballot, that could drive up a lot of Democrat independent turnout. I'm not saying it's easy for a Democrat to win in Schweikert's district, but it's way too soon. We don't know if there will be, hypothetically a criminal referral from this. Maybe not. And to the point about, it's a chief of staff, well, it's kind of like a basketball coach. Are you in charge of your staff? Is there compliance there? Should you know what your staff is doing? That's up for debate. Some people say that. I can tell you one thing. On a campaign flyer, if you say my opponent's under criminal, an ethics investigation, possibly being looked into by the FBI, whether it's, totally factual or not, that can move the needle a little bit too.
In terms of that, though, I mean, like, it is his chief of staff, but he also doesn't come off looking very good in this report. I mean, there's a lot about, running the office in a bad way and, like, it being, there's no oversight over what other people were doing and being generally disliked also by his staff here. Does that have any effect, Paul?
Well, certainly it does. But, I mean, we're seeing the same thing with the president right now with Kellyanne Conway. I mean, it's easy to, blame the media, blame other folks, and that his constituents, the people who really like him, the conservative Republicans, are not going to care about that because it's just a witch hunt. And I think one point to note, though, is this. The blue wave was real, and it happened in 2018, and we saw massive Democrat and independent participation in 2018, but not in this district. The typical participation is plus 19. In this last cycle, it was plus 17. It is a majorly Republican district, so he can use those same tips and tricks like the president has and, blame the media and other folks, and I think he'll be okay. Now, if the investigation goes further, if there's more that's revealed, if there's charges involved, then I think we could see something there. But it's just he's more vulnerable to another Republican coming in or maybe an independent. I just don't see a Democrat challenger having a shot at this.
Well, Paul, even with this report, the 424 pages and all the things that are in there, is there any consideration when it comes to David Schweikert considering, resigning or not running for re-election? I almost feel like, not to put it all on him, but there is that sort of arrogance of certain politicians to think, I didn't really do anything wrong, or my chief of staff did it. Do people ever actually think about that and say, well, maybe this is better for my reputation, be with my family, whatever it may be?
Well, I think there's external pressure, and it depends on if I think folks will come to him and encourage him. I don't think he's going to come to that decision on his own. But if somebody like Phoenix City Councilman Jim Waring, who's long coveted that seat, decided to jump in that race, that might make a big difference with external pressure. He's been proven to be a good fundraiser and, walks through two pairs of shoes every time when he goes knocking on doors. I mean, something like that might motivate that. But in and of itself, if it's just a Democrat external challenger, I don't see that happening.
Yeah, the number one goal of most politicians is self-preservation, as we know. So I think it would take someone from the D.C. establishment saying this investigation is not going your way, David. I think it's time to wink, wink, maybe step aside and do something else with your life while we get another person in there who could probably defeat a Harald Tipper Nanny pretty easily.
Okay.
What are the odds of that happening in terms of, you guys have any predictions if this is going to go further for him, if there will be further repercussions from this?
Well, remember, this investigation started under a Republican-controlled House.
Right.
It's now a Democrat-controlled House, so they can control the levers of power. From what I've been told from my friends who have worked in congressional staffs back there, they do try to be pretty judicious with what's a criminal referral. So it really depends on where this investigation goes, the next step. Is it dismissed? Is there a criminal referral? So I think a lot's to be determined for Schweikert and his future in politics.
This is a little different than, say, Congressman Trent Franks. And this is not a personal or social issue. This is a campaign finance issue. At the end of the day, that's a big yawn. I mean, that's really unfortunately. I mean, there's real allegations here and probably a misspending of funds. There's no doubt. But at the end of the day, that's not enough to chase people off. It's going to have to be something bigger. Something more is going to have to come to light. Otherwise, I think this, even in probably the largest turnout we've ever seen, he probably wins this. It'll be closer than usual. But, I mean, Tipper Nanny got close, but didn't win. I mean, still lost by 5 points. That's great, you know, but we hand out participation trophies in Little League, not wow. in congressional Ooh. Races.
Now, Paul, you're...
Paul needs to switch to decaf, I think. I'm just kidding.
Paul, the point about Waring is an interesting one, though, too, because Schweikert, even when he was Maricopa County Treasurer, he has run as someone who is really good with numbers, doesn't get involved in the social issues. So that's why I was wondering if there was something here, because you mentioned campaign finance being a big yawn. Yeah, for most people, but Schweikert sort of runs on stuff like that.
Sure. I mean, he does, but at the end of the day, again, he can point, it's my chief of staff, there's questions here, it's a witch hunt, you know, there's muddled messages. It's really tough to pin it on him unless some charges or something else comes out of this, because at the end of the day, it's a 400-page report. Nobody's going to take the time to read through all of that. I think the Arizona Republic article about the saying he doesn't like him and you know, the internal office scandal makes more and better news than some report does, I think.
Okay. I think the next thing to look for is when the next campaign finance reports come out, which is end of June, right, Paul, I think?
Yeah, I think that's right.
If Harold Tipernini has outraised Congressman Schweikert significantly, mm-hmm. that will boost her campaign. I'm not saying it's going to matter a ton, but that will be the next you know thing to watch for.
And numbers do matter in congressional races, and fundraising does matter. And if his fundraising numbers are anemic, I do think that'll be time where some people might come to him and say, hey, you've got a problem here. I just – nothing's really come about yet that I think it shows that.
Well, one final thing before the break just about the district, because I also live in that district, Chip, is that the district has become, from a legislative standpoint, even more conservative. When I moved there 15 years ago or so, certainly represented by Republicans, not a surprise, but much more conservative Republicans now. So I wonder if that even brings up Paul's point about it being that much harder to defeat Schweikert, because these are – hardcore Republicans. These are not Republicans who say, oh, more funding for K-12, let me move to the left. They're not doing it.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, like a Chandler, Ahwatukee area where there's a lot of folks who work at Intel, you know, smart, well-read, well-educated. But you look along the Shea Boulevard corridor in Scottsdale, there's a lot of those people too. So it's interesting how our congressional district, our legislative district has skewed more conservative and not to the middle. And I wonder if 2020-22 is when it goes a little more purple. Maybe not, but you have those characteristics of a Chandler and Ahwatukee.
That is Chip Scutari. Also here is Paul Bentz with Lauren Gilgram, Steve Goldstein. We're in the midst of the Friday Newscap, which continues after this. And thanks for listening to the Newscap on this Friday morning in Phoenix with Lauren Gilgram, Steve Goldstein. Our guests today are Paul Bentz of High Ground and Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlak. I've been wondering how you got that name, Chip. But anyway, it's a very creative
name. It's a good story, but I'll save it for another time.
So let's talk a bit about the governor over the weekend. So it's been several days, deciding to veto this per diem increase, which lawmakers passed sort of in the dead of night. And some lawmakers, especially the rural ones, are not happy about this. What do you make of the reaction to this? Because some people will say, well, maybe the rural lawmakers do deserve it, but not Maricopa County.
Yeah, I'm not surprised the governor vetoed this bit of legislation. I'm glad he did. I think they should work together collaboratively next session about what makes the most sense and make sure it doesn't affect the current lawmakers that when it will go into effect after the 2020 election. And also, I know most of my friends think I'm crazy, but our state lawmakers are so underpaid. For what they do, they should make $50,000 or $60,000 a year. If you look at the scrutiny they're under and contrast it with our two U.S. senators and our congressional members, reporters know way more about what your state senator is doing down there. They deserve more money, and I think the per diem issue can be worked out next session.
Well, Paul, that actually begs the question I was not going to ask, which is if, in fact, as we've talked about this before, if they were making $50,000 or $60,000, would we have more competitive primaries? Would we have potentially better candidates?
I think so. The problem is every time it goes before the voters, they always vote it down. The challenge here is they should not have done something to benefit themselves. Nobody should ever vote themselves a pay increase. You should have waited till the next legislative session, should have done it prospectively and had a more transparent process. You mentioned it, dead of night. Nobody's going to support a pay increase in the dead of night. But the challenge here is that if you live outside Maricopa County, it was a 135-day session at $185 a day. They made almost $25,000. They almost doubled their salary. So it's not that they, you know, they can cry the poorhouse here, but there's really a little bit of a challenge. But the big challenge is, so Gila Bend is in Maricopa County. It's 68 miles away from the Capitol. Apache Junction, on the other hand, if, depending on where you live in Apache Junction, you could be in Pinal County and get the per diem, and you're only 37 miles away. What we really should be talking about is some sort of distance from the capital or some other way besides the county designation to feel this. But it should be a transparent process. There's changes that need to be made. Our legislators should be paid more. But they should do this in the light of day with everybody involved and make it more transparent.
One other really basic point, but I don't want to sound like a condescending know-it-all, but they all got elected to office knowing what the pay was, knowing what the per diem was. And I understand it's tough for rural lawmakers, but that's what you signed up for. Sorry, you know. Yeah.
Is there a sense among lawmakers that they could do this differently? Like, why did they go about it this way? Did they think that no one's ever going to approve a pay increase for us otherwise, so let's just slam it in there while we can? There's no other option?
I think there's a little bit of that. I also think there's a little bit of conflict with the governor right now, and I think that was a hangover from the budget process and not really being upset about the process themselves and being there in the dead of night saying, we don't get paid enough to do this. And so I think we saw a little bit of that, but they got to find a way to work together. There's some strained relationships right now between the governor's office and the legislature.
And I thought when I heard about this issue, I thought this was going to be part of the budget negotiation. Hey, governor, you want this, you know, you're going to raise our per diem, but they didn't even do that. So they were outfoxed by the governor and his staff. It wasn't even a horse trade at all. It was just a bill after the budget. So I didn't really understand the strategy.
It's okay if neither of you know the answer to this, but how does this work in other states? Do lawmakers in other states make a significantly more amount of money?
Yeah, I know in California they do. There's no perfect system, because you don't want professional lawmakers. But we pay our state lawmakers based on, back in the agricultural days when, men had to go back to tend to their farms. I mean, it's totally different. But every state's different. Some have more, some have less. And a lot of my friends will say, you pay them more, it's not going to matter. I personally think it will widen the talent pool and be a lot better because there's not many people who can go from January to June almost full time and then go back to another life. You just can't do it.
I'm going to borrow Chip's air quotes for a minute. Allegedly, this is a quote-unquote part-time job.
Right.
And it's not. I mean, it is a full-time job, and we do need to increase the pay for legislators. I think I don't think the regular voters understand really what is involved with how much power the legislature has, how much is involved with their participation, how much more they have to do beyond the session. President Phan mentioned that they want to start working on the budget after Labor Day this year for next year's budget. So, I mean, I think there's a lot to this, and I mean, I think they should get paid more. The challenge is they got to make the sale to the voters on this.
Okay, guys, let's move on to Mayor Kay Gallego's first State of the City address as mayor of Phoenix. In a few minutes, we're going to hear sit-down interview Lauren actually did with Mayor Gallego. Both of you guys, I know, have some involvement in light rail to some extent, but I want to talk about that. That's an issue she decided to jump in on pretty without real safety. I mean, this was not dipping her toe in the water. Chip, what do you think? That was fairly aggressive that she showed support for light rail.
Yeah, full disclosure, our firm proudly works with Scott Smith and Valley Metro. But I was super impressed with Mayor Gallego. She went right in. She's a passionate advocate, not just of rail, but of mass transit in general, of what it's done for a region economically, connecting people. And I think she made a really strong sales pitch while people should vote no on Prop 105 in August. And she didn't beat around the bush. It was very well. I thought the speech itself was very well written, very well deserved, delivered. And as you look around the room, sometimes you're at those political speeches and people are looking at their watches, looking at the phone, like, when's this thing going to end? I think she captured people's attention to the very end. It was very well done.
Okay.
It was an incredibly strong inaugural State of the State speech or State of the City speech. I think she did a great job. I heard one comment, she reminded people of cinema. Like, she was poised, thoughtful, very commanding of, very well messaged. But her support of transit and her support of the city is longstanding. She was the face and the chairman of the Prop 104 campaign for the Transit 2050. She's been there before. It's not a surprise that she stood up there. But really, at the end of the day, she stood up for 30 years of transportation planning and three votes of the people. She is on the side of angels on this issue and is really... she's right. And I think she did a good job, kept it brief, kept it thoughtful, did pay some homage to some of her more conservative members of the council. But You know, she's right. We should not let a dark money group destroy Phoenix by singling out one thing they don't like.
Do we know where this stands at this point? Like what the polls are showing about this upcoming vote on light rail? Because this could be a really big upset if it goes the other way.
Yeah, it could be devastating. I think the private polling I've heard about has been pretty strong for light rail.
Yeah.
Just the connectivity, just all the benefits to the region. I think when people know that we've approved this three times, that I think we could lose up to $3 billion in federal funds that could go to other cities. And that this is, it's so important people know this isn't a South Central issue, just about the South Central extensions. This is about all light rail extensions, losing that federal dollars. And it's not an either or proposition. I know the opponents say, oh, well, it's cut light rail funding, we'll put it in the streets. There's $8 billion for streets and roads over the next 30 years. So it's not an either-or proposition.
The polling I've seen shows that light rail is incredibly popular. People want it. Now that it's here to stay. That issue is settled. We are not going to continue to litigate whether or not light rail should exist. So this idea of just unilaterally getting rid of it and stopping it from here on out is not popular from everything that I've seen. But it does take a fight because people don't know, as Chip mentioned, that the opponents or the proponents say it's an either-or proposition. It is not. There's plenty of money to fund Phoenix's streets, but they try to make it an either-or proposition, which is a challenge they have to face.
And so let me jump in with one quick thing, which is not related to Mayor Gallego, but what about this quote where someone said that former Congressman, the late Ed Pastor, the fact that he supported light rail is the reason he died at the age. I mean, when it comes to that kind of rhetoric, how does that hurt a cause?
Yeah, I mean, it was from a light rail opponent. I don't know the lady. It was despicable, and I feel horrible for Congressman Pastor's family, especially Councilwoman Laura Pastor. It was just, it was terrible. Unfortunately for the anti-light rail crowd, they're going to be stained with that now forever. But it was just completely despicable and uncalled for and unnecessary.
Yeah, Paul, you've been involved in dirty campaigns. I don't mean from your side, of course. No. I mean campaigns that get dirty. Sorry about that.
Right.
Didn't mean
it
like that. Let me phrase that very quickly, yes.
Hit the nail on the head. It's despicable. It's a despicable comment. It doesn't involve it should not be in this political theater here. I've been in meetings where women have done cartwheels over the support of transit. I mean, transit discussions get a little wacky to begin with, but this is so beyond the pale, it's unbelievable.
One last question about Mayor Gallego then, having sat down with her, and I agree with your assessment of the speech. What does this say in the political circles that are talking about it right now about her, the tone she's setting for, the next several years she'll have in office and what she's aiming to do here?
I mean, I think her speech reflected what her first term will be. She's very smart, strategic, organized, very strategic about where she wants to take the city, very hardworking. She's got a lot of, as I think Paul mentioned, a lot of characteristics of Senator Sinema. I mean, just really off the charts, smart, organized, know where they want to go, pragmatic, though. Not far left, not far right, kind of going down the centrist path.
She's got an incredibly bright future. I think that the speech indicates that. It'll be interesting to see if she's able to wrangle this new council. The council is a pretty diverse group mm-hmm. with a wide range of opinions all the way from incredibly progressive to incredibly conservative. So she's got some navigating to do, but I do think she set the right tone.
All right, that is Paul Bentz of High Ground, Chip Scutari of Scutari and Sizlike. Guys, thanks for being here. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Good morning. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein with Lauren Gilger. As a reminder, we're doing things a bit differently this summer. We're from 9 until 10 this summer, focusing on the stories of our state, and that means the takeaway airs from 10 to 11 as we follow this summer schedule.
And now we turn back to Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, who gave her first State of the City address yesterday. She highlighted many of the main achievements she's made in just the first few months in office and spoke out on issues ranging from affordable housing and homelessness to the challenges police face on the front lines of the behavioral health response. She spent much of her speech, as we mentioned, defending light rail, which has become increasingly controversial as opponents claim it will hurt businesses and benefit few. Voters will once again determine the future of light rail in August.
With more people moving to Phoenix, traffic is getting worse, especially in the central city. Light rail is simply the most effective way to move large numbers of people in finite spaces.
I sat down with the mayor yesterday at City Hall just after her speech and asked her what she has done in her first 12 weeks in office to set the tone for the rest of her tenure.
Before I ran for office, I worked in economic development. I've been very focused at bringing high-wage jobs to the area. Today we talked a lot about how we're partnering with our universities and our healthcare companies to grow our economy, particularly in that direction. We want to be one of the places that are part of curing cancer in this community. We want to be the center for healthcare innovation. We're working with our small startups. I celebrated one, Oncomix Therapeutics, just got $25 million. They have a great company that has a product where they have viruses that kill cancer cells and don't bother the healthy cells. So that's just the type of great innovation that we're trying to put forward in the community. Transportation infrastructure is incredibly important to me. I talked about how much the light rail has meant to our city, connecting our airport with our downtown, allowing us to bring ASU to the vibrant urban core. This August, the voters will have a chance to weigh in about whether we want to continue to invest in light rail. We have voted not once, not twice, not three times, and we'll vote four on the light rail. So it's important that we have that conversation about what it's meant for our city and whether we want to invest in the future. It was fun for me. I had a couple special guests who were there with me, a gentleman named Johnny Hernandez, who is a South Phoenix native. He was able to get to college thanks to taking a bus to light rail to a bus. If we build the South Central Light Rail extension, that commute will be so much easier for him and equally important for his fabulous daughter that he's raising in that community. Another favorite guest of mine was a woman I met on my first day as mayor. Monique experienced homelessness as a young person. She found a great place to live through Native American Connections, one of our nonprofit partners. The entire time that she was homeless, she was still pursuing her dream. She was in dental school, and just this Monday, she got her first full-time job. She's graduated. All of that while fighting an unstable housing situation. With that kind of resiliency, I feel like her future is bright, and it's fabulous that the city of Phoenix can partner with nonprofits to help people like her.
You hit on two of the issues I wanted to touch on there, but let's start with light rail. So like you said, this is coming up for another vote in August. And I've interviewed a lot of people in South Phoenix about this. I've interviewed you about this before. And tensions are really even ramping up, I think, from there. What do you say and how do you go from here to convince those people, especially those businesses along Central, that probably will be affected by this and could have some hardship as the construction goes on, that this is worth it?
I look at the $11 billion of investment along the light rail, 35,000 new jobs. I hope that it will be a real win for the people and businesses who are already there, bringing new customers to the South Side and to our warehouse district. We have great nonprofit partners and city programs to help people along the extension invest in their homes and take advantage of what's coming. Construction is never easy. The same is true if we're building a road project or a flood control project, but we've gotten a lot smarter and a lot faster about doing it. We will have record levels of business assistance on this project. This debate has gotten very emotional. We had what may be the all-time low for the Phoenix City Council last week. A woman came and spoke to Councilwoman Laura Pastor and said that God had taken her father and given him a heart attack because he supported the light rail. I was deeply disappointed that someone would play politics with the death of a loved one. That's not appropriate, and I think it's important as elected officials that we point out it is fair to have a debate on this issue, but we should stick to the issues and the facts and not attack people personally.
Do you understand the sort of mistrust that many of the people in that community have of the city and of the government in general, though?
I also hear from people that this is the investment they are due to get. People who feel that they haven't always gotten their fair share of investment on the South Side and south of downtown. The light rail extension will go through one of the city's two concentrations of public housing. These are individuals who have not had a lot of breaks in life, who have not had it easy, and who complain that they don't always get the nicer investments. So to me, it's important to deliver for everyone in our community. Our public housing includes many veterans and people with disabilities. They prefer light rail. It's easier than things such as the bus system, where they may have to lower a bus, you get on, then someone buckles you in. On light rail, you can just roll on grade and go. It gives you that independence that our veterans crave.
I want to also ask you about affordable housing. You brought up homelessness initially, which is, I know, a big issue the city is tackling. You said in the speech that you know there is not enough affordable housing in the city, that this is a challenge for the city. What does that look like in terms of addressing the shortage of affordable housing? Does it look like, you know, partnering with nonprofits to make sure that they can build those kinds of units? Or does it look like working with developers and ensuring that there are more affordable units within a new development? What are your plans?
This is a huge problem facing our community. We have been number one in rent growth, which is great if you own an apartment building, but difficult if you are on a fixed income and just trying to make it. So we need to be investing in more affordable and workforce housing. It's important to partner with nonprofits, and we're trying to get more aid out in the community. We're also trying to make sure that people who have a hard time making their bills have access to programs that will prevent eviction. It is easier to prevent homelessness than to solve it on the back end once it's occurred. So I talked a lot about what we could do to help people who are living paycheck to paycheck. It's not just eviction assistance, but also some of the reforms we're doing with our courts, where when people get something that may seem small to some individuals, but a parking ticket can escalate with all the fines and fees, especially if you don't pay on time. That reform is important. I spoke about a new position the city has created to coordinate all of our resources across departments. For example, the airport owns a fair amount of land along the light rail corridor. That has great access for transportation, so people don't have to spend all those dollars on a car. If we can activate that now vacant land and turn it into mixed-use housing that includes affordable and workforce housing, that can be a great solution for our residents. So it's taking everything from financial incentives the city can offer, permitting, our land, and trying to put it all together, focused on solving this problem.
I also want to ask you about the ongoing crisis involving asylum seekers being dropped off by ICE in the city. Just last week, two organizations presented at City Hall and said, we need help from the city. We need more help. We need more resources. Our volunteers are overwhelmed. We can't handle it at this point, and temperatures are rising outside. What are your plans at this point? Does the city need to do more?
I'm a huge believer that local government is the most effective form of government. We're the closest to the people. I do think it's important to remember that this is a responsibility of the federal government. They have created this issue. They are in charge of our immigration system, and they need to take the lead in solving it. But I have to face reality, and they're not right now. The faith groups and nonprofits have been the heroes of this situation. They have stepped up in really impressive ways. My office is working very closely with them, as is the city, to address the challenges. I'm particularly concerned as the summer heat hits that we make sure we have places where people can be and escape triple-digit temperatures. Right now, that solution is our summer heat program. That is not the ideal solution and not a great long-term fix. So we're trying to work with nonprofits to put more and more infrastructure in place and to improve some of the logistics and transportation challenges that people are facing right now.
Is there a sense that the city could, you know, open up a facility, open up the fairground, something like that, to try to provide more housing, more blankets, more beds for these people who need it?
It is important to me that if we are going to have people in a city-owned facility, that it be a safe facility. We have hundreds of people looking for places to be. We need to follow things like making sure people are safe from fire, potential fire or other problems. There's real challenges if not everyone speaks the same language. So we're trying to adapt existing buildings and look for paths forward, but we also have to keep safety in mind as we do that.
All right, Phoenix Mayor Kate Gallego, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for covering this.
If a contentious citizenship question ends up on the 2020 census, it could cost Arizona a much-hoped-for 10th congressional seat. That's according to a new study. The concern is that Hispanics, even some who are citizens, will avoid the census altogether out of fear for themselves or their undocumented family members.
We assume that Hispanics are going to respond negatively to the citizenship question and they might potentially be undercounted, then that suggests that states with large Hispanic populations but lower populations otherwise are potentially the states that are going to be affected.
That is Bryce Dietrich, an assistant professor of political science at the University of Iowa. He helped conduct that study. And now here to tell us more about what this could mean for Arizona is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, good Friday to you.
Good Friday morning. Yes, a lot of this is going to govern Arizona's political future.
So how involved is Governor Ducey and his administration in trying to, I don't know, convince the Trump administration to not be quite as eager to do this, or Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross?
How about none? essentially, what the governor said is, look, we want everyone counted. He signed an executive order. He likes executive orders, to say we're going to go and do outreach and we're going to tell people how important it is for folks to go ahead and do the census. I mean, that part is the clear part. The question becomes how much good that will do given what this study found. And as you point out, and as Bryce Dietrich points out, we've got some evidence here based on some studies they did, is that when you take identical groups and put it two sets of questions, one that has a citizenship question, one that doesn't, the Hispanics are more likely to avoid the questions in the one that has a citizenship question. That leads to questions of undercount. And there's some real significant numbers here. I mean, they suggested that it would undercount the Hispanic population in Arizona by about 362,000. Well, here's why that's important. Arizona hopes to get a 10th congressional seat. That's based on the fact that since the turn of the decade, we've added 780,000 residents so far, probably a few more by the time we get to 2020. If you subtract out 363,000 from that, essentially, we're at the same growth rate as the rest of the nation, in which case, we don't get a 10th congressional seat.
There's also, though, Howie, like a fear of loss of federal funding here. This also could have to do with a vote in the Electoral College for our state, right?
Oh, definitely, because we get 11 electoral votes now, the 9 House seats plus the 2 Senate seats. It would be nice to have more electoral votes, because then maybe candidates might pay more attention to us, given that, as we found out in the last election, it isn't the popular vote that matters, it's the Electoral College. That becomes number one. Number two, as you point out, is the fact that you're dividing up billions of dollars of federal funds based on issues of population. You know, things like road funds, things like Title I funds for schools. And if you have an undercount, then we're not getting the accurate numbers. And we're not getting the accurate numbers, we're not getting the money we deserve.
Well, Howie, even though this conversation has been short, we just have a few seconds left, and I will go back to my first question then. Well, that all being true then, why wouldn't Governor Ducey, why wouldn't some of our congressional members be more outspoken about this?
Well, there's a theory, and obviously I didn't get this from Mr. Ducey, but there's some evidence out there that Republicans believe that if you're only counting citizens, that if non-citizens, i.e. Hispanics, or even citizens who are Hispanic, don't register, that's fewer Democrats, which basically means that when they do the redistricting, the Republicans win. And that's part of the reason this is in court now. We're waiting for the U.S. Supreme Court to look at it and decide whether this was done for legitimate statistical purposes or just for political purposes.
Wow. So I think we know the answer to that, right, Howie? It's going to be political purposes, but we're not naive. I mean, I may be more than you, but we're not, right?
Well, we leave it to our more than intelligent listeners to see whether A plus B equals C.
Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, have a good weekend. Thanks.
You too.
Six months after an incapacitated woman gave birth to a baby boy at Hacienda Healthcare, Phoenix police have released their report into their investigation to some news outlets. Joining me now to talk more about the report is KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Good morning, Kathy.
Good morning, Lauren.
Okay, so what do we know so far from this report?
First, a little background. Police arrested Nathan Sutherland in January after his DNA matched that of the baby's. Sutherland provided over 1,000 hours of care between 2017 and 2018, despite her family requesting that only female staff provide care. As for that report, the Arizona Republic obtained more than 600 pages of that report through a public records request, and they're reporting that co-workers of Sutherland, the man who allegedly raped her, noticed his appearance had changed drastically, that he became more unkempt, etc. He had also become depressed leading up to the birth. Colleagues thought it had something to do with the divorce he was going through.
According to the notice of claim that was filed by the woman's attorney in May said in it that it said that the woman had likely been abused for years and possibly had been pregnant in the past. Did this new report shed any light on that?
Yeah, you know, it did. I do want to caution our listeners, though, the next part contains some information that might be a little upsetting to some of our listeners. According to the reports from the Republic, the police interviewed a doctor who thought she could have been pregnant before. The report said the woman, quote, had been sexually assaulted multiple times and that she showed no signs of common injuries to first-time pregnancies. And remember, in that notice of claim, there was evidence of prolonged trauma that was not related to the birth. Mm-hmm. She also had second-degree perineal lacerations, which were old and suggest a history of vaginal penetration or trauma.
Did Sutherland's colleagues suspect him of doing something like this?
The Arizona Republic reports that some co-workers thought he was a little too friendly with female staff, but appears to have been well-liked, even by some patients, according to the reporting. But in terms of being the prime suspect, no. The police report also indicated that the young woman had a roommate who was also incapacitated but cognizant. Hmm.
So what are the next steps in this case for Sutherland?
He has pleaded not guilty to the charges of sexual assault and abuse of a vulnerable adult. There is a hearing set for July 16th, and I just heard from the woman's attorney, and at this point they're not commenting on the police report.
All right, that's KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie. Kathy, thanks.
Thanks, Lauren.
Industrial hemp is legal in Arizona. That follows President Trump's signing of the 2018 Farm Bill, which moved hemp out of the category of illegal substances. But rules are still being finalized here, and farmers are considering whether to add hemp to crops they're already growing. There's a buzz around the crop, and a number of farmers have already applied to have it on their land. To get more details, I'm joined by Chelsea McGuire. She's Director of Government Relations for the Arizona Farm Bureau. Chelsea, why is hemp both exciting and daunting for Arizona's agricultural sector?
The answer to that question, both of those questions, is because it's new.
Okay.
And new things are both exciting and daunting at the same time a lot of the time, but especially when it comes to hemp. It's exciting because there's a market for it, and it's a market that Arizona farmers haven't had the opportunity to take advantage of because we haven't been growing hemp for so long. It's daunting because we don't know how it's going to grow here in Arizona. How much water is it going to take? What is the THC concentration going to do based on how hot it is or how dry it is? Those are all things that are big question marks right now, but will make a very big difference in how profitable this crop ends up being.
So if there's a process that you know yet, which you may not, but what are some of the steps in terms of getting more comfortable, getting more information?
I think it's just going to take growing the crop. We're going to have to get some seeds in the ground. Our guys are going to have to see what does it take, how much water are they using, what are their input costs look like. It's really going to be this big experiment at the beginning of how well does this work, and then what can we do to improve it going forward.
How much interest have you heard so far?
Quite a bit. The Department of Agriculture released some numbers for us on Friday, and just growers, so this doesn't include processors, harvesters, anything like that, we've had 140 growers apply for a license to grow hemp. 40 of those applications have already been processed and are ready to go, so those guys are ready to put seeds in the ground, and about 36,000 acres across the state are in the process or certified to be planted in hemp.
When can we expect to see some sort of results that are measurable?
Mm-hmm. Well, it will depend on how long the growing season ends up being for hemp, but our best guess, we do have some farmers who currently have plants either in greenhouses or are planting right now. So we're thinking probably in this fall we'll know some results of some of those crops.
Okay, so let's come back to what you said about THC content, which we don't know, because that when people hear hemp, that's the thing they magically go to immediately.
Exactly.
So is there something in there when it comes to even perception, the general public? Does that matter? Do farmers, are there some farmers who maybe don't want to grow it because of the potential connection to what they think of as an illegal drug?
Right. It does matter. It matters in terms of public perception because a lot of times public perception turns into regulation. And so if you've got folks who maybe aren't familiar with the industry, they aren't familiar with what hemp is and what you can do with it, it can be very easy for them to hear hemp, to understand, hey, there's a connection between hemp and marijuana. I don't want that in my neighborhood. I don't want that in my backyard. That's going to take some educational initiatives. I think the fact that the 2018 Farm Bill decriminalized hemp as a Schedule I drug is definitely going to help. That was something that the public heard about a little bit more widespread, and it means that we don't have to worry about federal prosecution, and there's a whole process in place right now to develop those rules at the federal level. But yeah, it's absolutely something that I understand why the public has that perception, but it's just going to take realizing that hemp is, as Senator Sonny Borelli was so often quoted saying, it is rope, not dope.
Is that wholly accurate?
It is. Okay. It is wholly accurate. So industrial hemp is, by definition, a plant that has less than 0.03 concentration of THC. So really, if you were to try to get some sort of high or, you know, state of being from hemp, you'd probably die of smoke inhalation before anything else happened.
How potentially large is the market?
We have a significant import market. And so if our domestic product can come in and take the place of that import market, there's a lot of potential here economically for our farmers. But again, that's going to have to make sure that they can actually grow the crop economically, which we've got to figure that out first.
In some ways, with every industry, is there a need for a shot in the arm? And could hemp provide that?
I think so. Arizona agriculture is an extremely strong and vibrant industry here in Arizona. We're a $23.3 billion industry annually, but that doesn't mean that we're not looking for ways to diversify and spread across risk. That's really always the biggest threat to agriculture, is that it's mainly geared on things we can't control. We can't control the weather. We can't control how much it rains. And frankly, we can't control international commodity prices either. You know, farmers are price takers, and so they don't have the luxury of going out onto the market and saying, here's my product and here's what I'm charging you for it. Mm-hmm. They have to take the price that world markets, truly world global markets, set. So there's never a bad time, or there's never a time when agriculture isn't looking for something to say, hey, how do we make this a more stable industry for our growers?
So you mentioned the precipitation, you mentioned Mother Nature. We're not real sure about that all the time. Is it true that hemp could potentially use a lot less water than other crops?
That's the speculation at the moment, yes. I think it's really going to be dependent on temperature. So there may be certain seasons or certain times of the year when it's taking less water. Obviously, summer, it's going to take more water just because it's so much hotter outside. But that is sort of the hope at the moment. And looking at what other states have done, comparable states, that is what pretty much everybody's estimating, that we'll be able to grow this crop with a high yield and a high quality with less water than maybe we're using on some of our more traditional crops.
Chelsea McGuire is Director of Government Relations for the Arizona Farm Bureau.
You belong among the wildflowers. You belong in a boat out at sea. Sail away, kill off the hours.
If you can believe it, Steve, this year marks the 25th anniversary of Tom Petty's album Wildflowers. The album has become ingrained in the fabric of American music since.
And many of us have a Tom Petty story, maybe a memory of hearing him on the radio for the first time or listening to his albums on repeat with friends or your parents?
Well, you know, I kind of came late to the Tom Petty train.
That's local singer-songwriter Brian Chartrand. You might recognize him from his work on The Project, Live with Laurel Canyon, or the band The Sweet Remains.
I remember when these songs were being released, and I guess at that time, it didn't really speak to me. I needed to, I think, mature a little bit. And I'm actually a songwriter myself, so I feel like my songwriting had to improve and find the depth that he was speaking to, singing about, before I could really, truly appreciate it.
And that appreciation has bloomed into a tribute concert. Chartrand and fellow musicians Jay Allen and Matthew Thornton will be performing Wildflowers cover to cover at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts tonight at 8:30.
This year is a milestone not just for the Wildflowers album, but also for Tom Petty's first solo record, Full Moon Fever, which turns 30 this year. Chartrand and the others will play several songs from that album as well. He says there's a special poignancy to being able to play the late musician's music.
I mean, obviously, since we have lost Tom, he's still very much in our hearts, and we're still talking about this amazing musician who still is contributing to how American popular music is played and written. And, you know, obviously he's one of the best American songwriters of our time. So really cool to be able to celebrate this music and keep it alive.
And if you're interested, tickets are still available for tonight's performance in Scottsdale.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.